It's Spoiler in Time, folks, the show where we take all of the hard work we do on Cord Killers and watch some shows and then spoil them. This week, we're going to be talking about The Larry Sanders Show, episodes 12 and 13 of season 3, Westworld season 3, episodes 5 and 6, and Better Call Saul, episodes 8 and 9 of season 5. I'm Tom Merritt. He's Brian Brushwood.
Hello. Let's go ahead and dive in, man. I'm hungry.
Let's spoil Better Call Saul. Now, we're going to be spoiling two episodes at once because we had some technical things, whatever, and we didn't do the spoiler in time last time. So this will be for Bagman and Bad Choice Road, which kind of go together, actually. It's a two-episode arc of Jimmy's trek into the desert, abandonment, shootout, trek back through the desert, and then what happens once he gets back alive with the money.
I am actually really, really glad that we are reviewing the two of these together as a unit.
Yeah, me too.
Because as a unit, it's quite good. If we had talked about it last week, I did not enjoy Bagman at all. Like, we got...
You said you hated it when we talked
about it. I hate it. Yeah.
Wow,
really? Well, because 15 minutes in, I knew how the rest of it was going to go. And there was absolutely no surprises, and all of it went exactly the way I expected it to be. And that's not normally things I find myself saying about Better Call Saul. However, the second episode, the fallout, dealing with the humanity and the terror and the repercussions, and if for nothing else, to see Kim Wexler stand up and call out Lalo as an effing amateur... that was extraordinary. So
my gosh, yeah. Especially because she knew Jimmy was lying. She knew. Jimmy didn't know she knew, but she did.
I think
she was like,
Jimmy,
well, I'm
going to
defend my man. Well, Jimmy might have suspected, but they hadn't talked about it, right? So it wasn't like Jimmy was like, oh my God, we just talked about how you caught me lying and now you're doing this, right? It was all Kim just deciding on her own to be like, you know what? I'm going to step up and I'm really good at talking. That's what I do for a living. And I'm going to talk this guy out of here. It almost, to me, showed that Kim is the better lawyer in more ways than one here, because she was able to talk the drug dealer out of their house and Jimmy couldn't.
Although it doesn't sound, from what Lalo said, like he was remotely convinced. I think that she cornered him.
That doesn't matter, right?
Right.
How many juries aren't convinced but find you not guilty because they have to, right? That's all she did. She put it into a situation where Lalo was like, you know what? The best thing for me to do is just leave now. Fine.
Well, but it sounds like he is going to do some work. He's not exiting the picture.
Oh, yeah. No, this case, there may be an appeal, if you will.
But what's interesting is the real jury was not even Lalo. The real jury was the listening sniper rifle holding Mike Ehrmantraut, where he's like, he had all of the power. And the question was, it was never spoken. Only implied is, okay, guys, how messy do you want this? How good can you do?
And I wonder how much that affects Jimmy when he knows he has a safety net, right?
Well,
he knows Mike Ehrmantraut is on the phone listening.
Right.
So he knows that there's a possibility that Mike could intervene. He doesn't know he's on the roof with a sniper, of
Correct.
Course. But there's something in his mind of like, well, but Mike's listening. Whereas Kim doesn't know that. Kim's like, the only way we have out of this is my talking.
Well, I mean, she knows. Like, she's smart. She's... as smart, probably smarter than Jimmy. She knows. And she doesn't need to know the specifics to know.
But she doesn't know Mike Ehrmantraut is there on the phone, does she?
No, but she knows the level of trouble that they're dealing with. And she knows the depths of the
fibs. What I'm trying to say is Jimmy had in his mind there might be a safety net. Kim didn't.
Yeah. And yet, I feel like she was the less afraid of the two, despite the fact... that she thought they were flying without a net.
I think that makes sense. A lot of times when we know there's a safety net, we let ourselves break down a little bit. Because like, well, but there might be someone to come save me, so maybe I'll just let them. Whereas if you don't have anything else, your back's up against the wall, then you stand up and do it.
Do you think that her quitting the job and making it specifically about being free of Mesa Verde was a gesture of I... if not, so there's two ways to interpret it, and the one I don't believe is They're just not worried about money because it seems like money's coming in. And so if she's going to do that, then not, you know, don't do the crap job that she hates. Do the stuff that she loves to do good, especially if she knows the money is going to be dirty money, then she can maybe offset that morally by doing pro bono work all the time. I don't believe that. I believe that she full on quit her job without ever saying why, but it's like, let me be an example. I think she is fighting for Jimmy's soul at this point. I think she sees the path that he's on and she's like, I will quit, you know, I'll quit all of this opportunity and convince him, or if it has even the tiniest possibility of convincing him to stop chasing the almighty dollar.
I don't think it's as simple as that. I don't think it's as noble as that. I think that that might even be partly subconscious of, my gosh, I love Jimmy. I'm stuck with Jimmy. I'm not leaving Jimmy. But we need to apply some good to this situation. Like, I think you're absolutely right about that. I don't know if it's as avowed of I need to save Jimmy, but there's a lot of bad coming from Jimmy's way. And if I can do good to combat that, maybe it'll help somehow. Right. I think that's a really good insight, is that's part of it. But I also think the money is, even if that's also subconscious, making that decision easier because, you know, it's there. If that money's not sitting in a duffel bag, she might not pull the trigger and she might not even know why. But I think that's a subconscious push of like, yeah, but, you know, I know it's dirty money, but if worse came to worse, I mean, we would have that money that's sitting there, right? That's got to affect you.
There might be a vague effect of like, well, regardless of where the money has come from, we clearly as a couple are entering a new phase of the levels of money that swing around us. And if we're in that new phase, then I'd rather not be doing Mesa Verde if that's where we are. But I don't know.
I hadn't even thought about that. It's also driven by concern. Like, I need to be flexible to save Jimmy sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It was sweet. Have you noticed... I'm sure everyone has noticed, but I never felt it more powerfully than over the last two episodes that the two of them have never said, neither one has said they love the other.
Yeah. It always made me wonder if this was a relationship of convenience, right?
I think it's like,
you know what? I like you well enough. I don't want to bother with the dating scene. We work well together, you know, but was it actually love or not? I've always wondered that.
Well, it's certainly, if there's ever a moment that it's appropriate to tell your husband and or wife that you love them, it would be after this, you know, during this time, which I always thought it was interesting that we just never saw the moments in their life that were that lovey-dovey where it would be appropriate to say it. But this was the first episode where it's like, shame on both of you for not telling the other how you feel at this moment.
You know, if you have to say it, it may not be as true.
Oh, please, Ryan. Get out.
Do you think maybe that is trying, because this takes place in the 90s, do you think it's trying to represent a 90s modern new type of relationship? You know, a very convenient...
Oh, like a Gen X slacker kind of feel?
That we both work and we know we love each other.
We don't need to say
And we make a lot of money. You know, we're lawyers. We're high... We're, you know, we're professionals. We just do what we need to do, and that doesn't
always... We're post-love.
Yeah.
No, I think that while that... I think it was popular in the 90s to have that sentiment. I think that they would have shown a spotlight on it if that's what they were going for. I think it truly is a I don't know, now you got me thinking.
Maybe it's because it kind of started off as the Saul show. I mean, it, and Kim became a
there.
Protagonist.
It's part of it, whether it's intentional or not. That definitely has the aspects of it.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, and Gambling Man is saying that this takes place around 2005, 2006, and it is close to Breaking Bad, so maybe.
But they're Gen X, the era.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there might be something to that. I also just want to put in a note, and this is not to even counter you, Brian, but I enjoyed the Bagman episode, even though I also knew where it was going. I wanted to see how Mike and Jimmy would interact in a survival situation, even if it was as I expected. It was enjoyable. I liked their two-man trek through the desert.
One other notable moment, like him, hate him, fear him, what have you, Gus Fring, That's oh, right. That was a cold move for him to just say straight up to Mike, no, I'm not letting Nacho go. He's a valuable asset. And yeah. And Mike, you know, just like, you got a gun to his dad's head. That doesn't sit well with me. Like, he didn't threaten. He didn't. Nope. He all he said is, that doesn't sit well with me. End of discussion.
The Mike and Fring that we see in Breaking Bad grows very naturally out of these conversations, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. As does the Mike and Saul that we see in Breaking Bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else on Better Call Saul?
No, good stuff, man.
Did you guys like the homage at the beginning of Bad Choice Road? The musical bit while Kim is waiting? Do you guys remember that? That's the same music that they play when they do the time skip many, many months while Kim is working with Mesa Verde.
Oh, I totally missed it. I have no memory of this part.
I don't remember the name of it, but it was like kind of a sort of a loungy kind of bossa nova-y sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's when she's like, you know, she gets, it's like kind of the montage and she's getting the trophies and then they're working on, and he's working through his probation. It's the same, song.
Good to know. Good to know.
The longest day.
Well, there you go. Those are episodes 5 or 8 and 9 of Better Call Saul.